Good morning and welcome to our roundtable discussion for this morning. WAMC's Alan Chartok joins us. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe.
We also welcome University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo to the discussion. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning.
And we are thrilled to have Malcolm Nance back, a counterterrorism and terrorism intelligence consultant for the U.S. government's Special Operations, Homeland Security, and Intelligence Agencies. He was our Alan's Vox Pop guest on Tuesday and is back to talk about the many issues because... A lot has changed just in 3 days, and we're thrilled to have Malcolm join us on the panel this morning. So welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning, everybody.
We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you this morning. Because of our special guest and because Malcolm's here, we're going to talk a lot about, as we always do, the top stories of the day. These all just happen to be obviously related to what is going on in the world. So let us begin with what is happening. The president made his announcement and his address to the nation on Wednesday, and yesterday on 9/11, there were many commemorations and a lot of talk about terror. The big news to come out of yesterday was that Arabs gave tepid support to the U.S. to fight against ISIS. And so now we also look at polls that say that Americans are weary of war, but they are favoring an airstrike plan. So let us begin there with the Arab support. Alan, what do you make of it?
Well, before I do, I wanted to ask Malcolm, who, after all, is our great expert on this. I noticed that France and everybody else is coming in, despite their in the polls, despite their issues with the gas that's coming in. You've been close to all of this. Obviously, there's a lot going on behind the scenes that we don't know about. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Geopolitically, France, Great Britain, most of Central Europe has a great stake in what happens, not just with ISIL, but what happens with all the al-Qaeda affiliates that are operating in North Africa, in Libya, Algeria, Mali, places which are part of the Francophone world. And as a matter of fact, France's chief concern appears to be the Islamists inside North Africa, Libya in particular. And they see that what's happening in the Levant, what's happening in Iraq and Syria, as being an extension of that, and that same part of that virus that will come in and infect them. So they're throwing their support behind it. I mean, even surprisingly, Germany is throwing its support behind the president.
I always tell my students that when you don't know something, don't feel like you're an idiot. Just ask the question. And the question is, what is the Levant?
Oh, it's a very good question. And as a matter of fact, I'm glad you asked that. You'll hear people refer to this organization as ISIS, which is short for Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. But the technical intelligence community term is ISIL, which is the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. And that's because they use the Arabic word al-Sham, which is a traditional word for what we would call the Levantine, which is Palestine, Israel, what's now Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. When that phrase was created during the Sykes-Picot Treaty period, it was a part of the Ottoman Empire. And that whole region from western Iraq to the water and down to Israel and Palestine to the Jordanian border is the Levant. And so when ISIS uses the term Levant, this is what they're talking about taking over. It's not just Syria, but their operations right now are centered in Syria and Iraq.
So when we look to this building of a coalition, what are the challenges that the U.S. and really the world face in building that coalition?
Well, unlike the last time we built a coalition, which was a coalition of non-Arab states to be involved in Iraq, which essentially to invade Iraq, this is going to be the opposite. And it's something which George Herbert Walker Bush actually had success in doing in the first Gulf War. It's another war that I fought in, where they got the Saudi Arabians, they got the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, the Emiratis, the Jordanians to combine forces and actually carry out the invasion of Kuwait to kick Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait in the first Gulf War. What we're intending to do is to create a coalition of nation states that will support U.S. operations and what appears to be, the president said, moderate Syrian forces to arm, equip them, and to fill the vacuum for when U.S. forces and possibly Iraqi forces, Kurdish forces, and maybe even Turkish forces degrade ISIS to the point where they no longer can hold terrain. So someone has to fill that terrain.
Well, it's interesting, Malcolm. The whole business with Turkey seeming to change its preferences on who their enemies are these days. I mean, the Kurds were the classic enemy, but all of a sudden they've got worse problems.
Yeah, it's much worse problems. In the old days when the Turkish were at war with the Kurdish Communist Party, the PKK, who, you know, one-third of Turkey is Kurdish, and northern Iraq, which is Kurdish also, was operating as an autonomous sort of nation state for a very long time. And there was this big joke while we were in Iraq or when you're up in Erbil that, you know, the Turkish will invade here, that the first sign that the Kurds will get liberation. However, that's completely changed now. The greatest threat that they have is not the Kurds. The Kurds themselves face an existential threat from ISIS. So now you don't see all of the machinations for the Kurds to destabilize the government of Turkey. In fact, you have two cooperating groups here.
And we'll talk about the U.S. is in the same position as Turkey, rethinking its enemies and friends. And I'm thinking of both Syria and Iran in this new coalition that's forming. We're suddenly friends with people we have not refused to speak to or we have actually fought in the past few years.
Well, I think using the phrase friend is might be stretching it out on the political
terms.
It's
like Facebook.
Right, yeah.
They're friend.
You're not going to see the White House like anybody on those two things. You know, we'll tolerate their existence for a while. But we've made it very clear that we have to get rid of Bashar al-Assad. And Iran, everything that's happened since 2003, the invasion of Iraq, everything has been in the interest of Iran.
That's true.
Yeah, it's so interesting the way that it's all sort of shifting. You have a president who is now going out of his way to say, we don't like Assad, we don't like Assad and we're not going to cooperate with him. But obviously, on some level, I suspect we're going to.
Well, cooperation is another one of those loaded terms. Yeah. A lack of cooperation on his part by his forces not carrying out any offensives and our forces carrying out airstrikes and, you know, special operations within Syrian territory to degrade ISIS. Again, someone's going to have to come in and fill that void, whether it's some of the other Islamist groups like, God forbid, al-Nusra Front, which was a branch of al-Qaeda, but just not as extreme as ISIS. Or what remains of the Free Syrian Army. One factor that most people don't realize is that starting last September, ISIS went out of their way to decapitate all of the commanders of every other rebel resistance group inside Syria. They carried out suicide bombings, assassinations, mm-hmm. kidnappings. There was just an attack on 29 leaders the other day. So, you know, they're sort of disorganized themselves. So whatever effort the White House makes is going to have to be channeled through the Arab partners, and then they're going to have to be injected into the battlefront in order to fill those voids and then move and take terrain with the U.S. airstrikes.
If you were the president, what would you do right now, Malcolm?
Well, I think that the strategy that he's outlined is as good as he's going to get. Without actually putting a large capacity of U.S. forces on the ground. There's going to be U.S. forces on the ground. You may be in an advisory role, maybe in a forward air control airstrike role where you put a laser onto your target and designate that for further terminal joint attack. But to tell you the truth, we discussed this on Tuesday. The one role that's missing here is counter-ideology. ISIS's ideology is the same as al-Qaeda's. It is al-Qaeda's ideology. It's just taken one step further. But another component of bringing all these Arab coalition states together is they have to go after why kids read their tweets from ISIS and then want to join the group, why they think beheading and decapitating in the name of what they believe God pleases God is most important. And that's going to take a strategic program amongst all of the Arab nations in order to stop the spread of the ideology.
In your book, you talk about that the key to defeating al-Qaeda is wise in counter-ideological warfare.
Right.
So as we look at the paper today and they talk about al-Qaeda weakening, have we been successful in that?
You know, that was a good article. And al-Qaeda has been weakened. But you have to look at al-Qaeda as a series of franchises that are spread out from the base ideology, which was created by Osama bin Laden and originated in Central Asia. That ideology has gone to Ethiopia, to Nigeria, to Mali, to Chad, to Libya, Algeria, Morocco, France, the United States. We've had people carrying out attacks in the name of that ideology.
Yeah.
So if you can go and kill the players all you want, but so long as that ideology is appealing to an individual and they want to become part of this train, this jihad, then you will never be able to exhaust yourself until you make it unappealing. And only the Muslim world can do that. We can't do it ourselves.
And speaking of that, are you persuaded that the response from the Arab countries, as we read in the New York Times, is tepid? I was actually surprised that he got as much cooperation as he did. And on top of that, right now, European countries have agreed to additional sanctions on our other zone of conflict against mm-hmm. Putin. It seems to me there is a lot going on behind the scene and that the president seems to be winning his way with some of our allies.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think one of the components that we have here with this White House that didn't exist in previous White Houses, and this is why you get people saying there's a lack of leadership, is they don't do big, sexy well, as we say mm-hmm. in the military. It's not all bombs, guns, and helicopter rides with this White House. And when it is bombs, guns, and helicopter rides, it's usually done with a covert force. It's done behind the scenes, like the attempted rescue mission of James Foley, or the three successful rescue missions in Somalia of American citizens. You know, these things happen. They go off the news radar. And so it is. What people want now is to see a broad, graphic spectacular which degrades ISIS in a way that they can understand. But ISIS and the forces that are out there that we have to engage around the world, that most things you will never see nor hear, that will be the most effective.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Malcolm Nance is joining us. Alan and Rosemary are here as well. We welcome your comments, as always, roundtable@wamc.org. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Topperson, natural medicine formula creams designed to heal muscles, joints, nerves, and skin conditions, including shingles and eczema. Topperson.com. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington. Offering organic and local groceries, working to build a healthy and sustainable community, Berkshire.coop. And Cultural Pittsfield, presenting third Thursday, September 18th, beginning at 5 p.m., featuring Walk a Mile in Her Shoes theme, part of a citywide cultural initiative, discoverpittsfield.com.
Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel. It is very nice to have you with us. Malcolm Nance joins us, a counterterrorism and terrorism intelligence consultant for the U.S. government special operations, homeland security, and intelligence agencies. Rosemary Armeo is here as well, and Alan Chartok joins us, and it is great to have you with us. And Alan, we have a letter or two.
Yeah, we have one from Libby, of all people. And who says...
And Alan, if you can just go a little bit closer to your mic there, we'll hear
okay,
you.
Okay, we'll do. Says Libby, the enemy of my enemy is my political necessity, strategy, eventual enemy again. Yeah, I think those are interesting questions.
Excellent. And do we have another?
If we do, it's from Men's Warehouse.
Okay. I thought there was one from Don.
From Don. I don't see one.
All right.
Don. Okay. If you see one, you can read it.
Okay.
No problem.
I will check on that. Rosemary, you had a question?
I do. I want this important question to get in before we go on to small things like Egypt and Ukraine, and that is this. Does taking my shoes off at the airport help keep this country safe?
Yes. I'm sorry to burst your bubble, but...
Why does it happen nowhere else on Earth, including Israel, which has much better airport security than we do?
Well, Israel has a very narrow group of people who must go through very thin channels to get to a country of very small size. The United States is a very, very broad-based nation. You can get to it from thousands and thousands of airlines. What we call going through your shoes, taking your shoes off, once we've determined that there was an actual threat that used this technique, you know, the explosive shoes, which is a great idea, as a matter of fact, as far as bombs go. What we do is...
Though it never worked.
Yeah, it didn't work, but it should have worked. And the only if it wasn't for the awareness of the passengers, it would have worked. What that does at the airport is that is a defensive trigger. It's designed for someone who is actually planning on doing this. It could be an emotionally disturbed person. It could be a terrorist. We are doing it in such a way that we want that person not to use that technique. We know they will never go back to that technique. And if they do go to that technique, it'll set off a series of panics in that person as they start to take off their shoes, put it in the X-ray tray, and let it go through that. So it's just one of those methodologies that, although it inconveniences millions and millions of people every day, there is technology that now does scan down through your feet. I wish they would buy more of those.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Again, going back to Israel, you said they use many more indicators than we do.
Sure, but they trust no one. They trust they don't even trust little old Jewish grand ladies.
Oh, we don't, you know, either. We don't
either. Yeah,
we're rude
either
to them. No.
We need better public, we need better customer service training at the airport.
Yeah, okay.
So now
I'll settle for that. I can bond with him now.
The British are nice.
All right. Now you've made a friend.
That's right. Pause that. We'll take a break, and then we'll come back, and then Alan will jump in. We want to hear from you. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. We will be right back on our roundtable panel on this Friday morning. Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel for this Friday. I almost said Saturday.
You're getting ready.
Yeah, I'm getting ready, I guess. Let me introduce our panel to you and of course, a reminder that we always welcome your letters, roundtable at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here, Rosemary Armeo is here, and Malcolm Nance is our special guest, a counterterrorism and terrorism intelligence consultant for the U.S. government's Special Operations, Homeland Security, and Intelligence Agencies. And it's wonderful to have him back in our studio this morning. Alan, we have a few letters.
We do. We got one from Tipikin, who says, I'm a middle-aged lawyer, and I think understanding and bridging the gap of understanding to the Arab and Middle East world would be usually facilitated by understanding Arabic. I see you speak Arabic. I've been working very hard to gain proficiency, but there are few courses, classes, etc., offered in Western Massachusetts that I can attend as a full-time state employee. I've taken 1.5 years at a local community college, and I'm at wit's end as to how to proceed. Any suggestions? I would love to be able to listen to Al Jazeera in Arabic.
That is obviously posed to you.
Yes, it is.
I said, wow, it's time for you guys to comment.
Yeah.
There's two components to this. It depends on what part of the Middle East that you're trying to get some access to. In the Gulf states, like Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, it surprises people when you speak Arabic. But after the first few pleasantries, there's a saying that Arabic opens doors to an empty room. So for the most part, they would prefer to speak English to you. But for as far as maintaining proficiency and getting some proficiency in Arabic, the best thing you could do is find someone who's local. In Western Massachusetts, I'm sure there are people who are native to the Middle East, and learn Arabic right there with somebody who speaks, because Arabic is actually a very easy language. With, you know, most people see the squiggly writing lines, and it's actually just handwriting. And so it's actually a relatively easy language to learn once you learn the basics. But it would open up more understanding. The other countries, Egypt, Libya, Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, most people are absolutely fascinated if you can speak Arabic, and they will become your best friend forever.
Okay, and let's see here. Gary, a regular participant, I'm a pacifist from the Vietnam era, saying that, here's my question, would it be better to just go with the powerful force and wipe out ISIS and Al-Qaeda quickly and finally, I fear that select bombing and in sending an advisor, CIA, will just prolong yet another Vietnam-like quagmire, costing another 4,000 young American lives and more trillions of dollars. What are your thoughts?
It's interesting coming from a pacifist that they would want a military solution. If Vietnam should have shown us anything, it's that look at the hardcore ideology of the nationalistic Vietnamese. They wanted their own nation. They wanted their own nation under one system, and the North fought tooth nail and lost 1 million men and women and children to get that. Sometimes you cannot beat a force through kinetic applications of force. That's military ease for bombing people. You really have to either negotiate your political position or you have to go after their belief system. Nazism, for example, National Socialism, was a belief system that was very easy to dismantle, but it also required a kinetic component. But, you know, when Bugs Bunny can show you just how horrible Nazism is, well, on the same scale, the same thing has to be done with ISIS. I'm not saying that we should have Donald Duck, you know, dancing to songs making fun of ISIS, but the Middle East has already done that. They've put out counter ideology things. Right. But now we need to facilitate and speak on the terms of what their true religion is and why this group is not legitimate.
Were you saying something, Rosemary?
No, not at all.
Okay, then Karen wrote, I'm thrilled Malcolm is back. He's the only voice of reason. Two questions. Given that there hopefully won't be...
the only voice of reason?
That's what he said. That's what she said.
On radio or in the earth or...
I don't know. There won't be sexy war tactics.
We agree.
How does Obama win the PR war? How do we help push, et cetera, the ideological war that just happened? Actually, you just answered that question, I think, rather well. So we'll move on to the famous Don. Now, Joe, Don's message finally showed up on my machine. According to many sources, Saudi citizens continue to represent a significant funding source for Sunni groups operating in Syria. Arab Gulf donors as a whole, of which Saudis are believed to be the most charitable, have funneled hundreds of millions of dollars to Syria in recent years, including to ISIS and other groups. There is support for ISIS in Saudi Arabia, and the group directly targets Saudis with fundraising campaigns. So Riyadh could do much more to limit private funding, U.S. funding. U.S. officials have hinted that a combination of politics, logistics, and limited capabilities have impeded more effective Saudi efforts to counter terrorism financing. And that's from Don, our old friend Don. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple of things in there that I think you may take issue with.
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, Saudi Arabia went through a terrorism war that the United States or that most Americans have no idea occurred. Between 2004 and 2009, Saudi Arabia was locked in mortal combat inside all the cities of Saudi Arabia with Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula. They were carrying out suicide bombings, attacks, murders. They actually tried to kill the Minister of the Interior, who is a Saudi, one of the senior members of the Saudi royal family, with a suicide bomb device that was implanted within the bomber. So Saudi Arabia understands the stakes. What I think they don't understand is that within their belief of Islam, that they believe that everyone is reconcilable, that everyone can be brought back to the religion. And that's how their counter-ideology programs work, where they bring them back, they buy them cars, they sit them down with 500 imams, and they show them that they were completely wrong. You can't do that with 20,000 combatants who are in another part of the Middle East. You have to literally re-engineer the global narrative of what ISIS's religious beliefs are, and it has to come from all throughout the Muslim world. You know, Qatar is another one of those countries that's a little strange. They fund, they're individual people, wealthy people fund groups like ISIS, and then they give us U.S. Central Command's headquarters in the Middle East at the same time. So you have to push these countries to sort of, you know, stop the cash flow, stop the private donations, which is zakat. A lot of these people think they're giving charity, which is one of the five pillars of Islam, when in fact, some of these people know that the charity that they're giving gives them those big sexy videos of suicide bombings and beheadings. And it's something that has to happen on a Middle East-wide scale, because this threat is existential to Islam. I don't think that's been put out in the media enough.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting.
We had a note from Kenner, who changed the subject a little bit, who said, how about countering Putin by emphasizing that his version of Orthodox Christianity is just as fake as ISIS's version of Islam?
Rosemary.
Well, I'm not sure that Putin works on the basis of religion in the same way that we see their groups using it in the Middle East.
Yes.
He's all about nationalism and patriotism, so I think that might not work so much. How about the Balkans, though? I know you've worked in the Balkans, Malcolm. That's certainly...
Yeah, the Balkans was a very funny place. I mean, I had been to Yugoslavia when it was Yugoslavia, and one of the rare U.S. Visits to Yugoslavia. And then when I went during the Serbian-Bosnian Civil War, I found that people who never went to mosque, Muslims who never went to mosque, right, Christians who never went to church, Croatian Orthodox who never went to the Orthodox Church, all fighting for their religion and trying to commit genocide in the name of it.
Yeah, it's Croatians who are Catholics, Serbs who are Orthodox.
Orthodox,
and
right.
And the Muslims. Mm-hmm. And out of that group, probably the most secular and unreligious were the Muslims until that war. The Gulf has gone in. There's mosques everywhere. You see women, far more women veiled and covered than used to be. So they've become more religious. Something, Alan, you know about this as the Jews were after World War II, when religion was not the issue. It was far, far greater than that. But suddenly religion got attention. If you're going to be persecuted for what religion, what God you pray to, then you are going to do some more praying. That seems to be what's going on there.
Bernie says, some people say that if we had remained in Iraq, then there wouldn't be an ISIS. Comment?
Oh, God, that's got to be the biggest fallacy that's out there right now. And it drives me crazy because Senator John McCain, who I respect, I mean, I taught at a school on McCain Boulevard at North Island Naval Air Station, named after him, his father, and his grandfather. I know all about what happened in his captivity. I think he's a great American. However, that is a absolute falsehood. ISIS is the fourth name change of a group called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They changed their name to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, then they changed it to the Islamic Emirate of Iraq, then Mujahideen Shura Council, then Islamic State of Iraq, then Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Same group, same ideology, new manpower, operating in the same regions, just that they have now a safe haven, that's Syria. So we're dealing with the same group that manifested itself after the U.S. invasion of Iraq. If we had kept 10,000 troops in Iraq or 1,000 troops in Iraq, we would have just had suicide bombings going after U.S. Army convoys or killing individual soldiers for the last, 2009, so for the last 5 years. They have never changed their ideology. Our removing ourselves from Iraq was because the government of Iraq did not want us to stay there. They wanted us to leave. They wouldn't sign the Status of Forces Agreement. It was George W. Bush's actual plan of withdrawal that we executed. So, you know, if a nation doesn't want you there, there's nothing you can do about it.
In fact, you thought we made a mistake going in the first place, right?
Oh, we should never have invaded Iraq. I mean, they didn't do anything to us, and it had nothing to do with 9/11. There were no Al-Qaeda groups in Iraq under Saddam's control until the week before we invaded, when he opened the doors up to everyone.
So how much are we paying the price now?
Oh, well, in treasure, trillions, in dead, 5,000 American citizens, 5,000 soldiers, 4,400 dead American soldiers. Iraqis, hundreds of thousands have died.
Wow.
So, you know, this is geopolitics at its absolute worst. I met Colin Powell's Army War College instructor just before the invasion. He said, "You're Arabic speaking, spy. What do you think?" And I said, "I don't see it. I don't see this mission. It just came up out of whole cloth in August of 2002. But I was working on contracts in January of 2002 that was orienting special operations towards Iraq and pulling us out of Afghanistan."
So who do you get the call from? Like, who do you – I'm realizing you may not be able to tell us completely who this is, but, like, who do you work for? Now when you get a call and you travel to these places –
Well, right now I work for you because we're establishing a think tank in Hudson, New York, on analyzing terrorist tactics and strategies. But
Who is we?
We? We have a whole slew of special operations, ex-special operations, ex-intelligence people who are all of the same mind in studying radical ideologies, particularly Al-Qaeda's ideology.
So who do you see tapping into the resource that you will provide?
Well, hopefully the White House here. I hope to be making contact with them and the Department of Defense to talk about our counter-ideology program, Circuit Breaker.
Let us take a break. We will be back and talk more and finish up this hour. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Washington County Tourism, featuring the arts throughout Washington County, including theater, dance, galleries, museums, music, performing arts, and more, WashingtonNYCounty.com. East Heaven Hot Tubs and Paradise Spa, Northampton, Massachusetts, offering private hot tub room rentals with indoor or outdoor rooftop tubs, massage for couples and individuals, eastheaven.com for information. And Healthy Living Market and Cafe, a family-owned natural food market, providing natural and organic foods, now open 7 days a week at the Wilton Mall, healthylivingmarket.com.
Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our discussion. It is very nice to have you with us. Roundtable at WAMC.org. And Alan, we got a few minutes, and I know we have a few letters. We'll finish up on those, and then we'll finish up our conversation.
Could you ask the panel, ask Mr. Nan, says Gary, as a black man who has spent his life protecting the U.S., how do you feel about the militarizing of the police and the all-too-often Ferguson situations in this country?
Oh, good question.
Good question.
That's a left fielder. Okay. Well, first off, like some of your listeners know if they heard Tuesday, I just moved back to the United States after 7 years overseas, living in the Middle East and working in Iraq and North Africa and East Africa. I'm quite surprised at what's going on back here. The mindset of the American public, this division within the government, it's fascinating. Just, there appears to be nothing that Americans can settle on anymore. The police have become more aggressive, it appears. No one needs an MRAP. That's a mine-resistant armored personnel carrier, a $1.5 million truck designed to be hit by IEDs. All of those should be pulled back off these police programs and sent right back to the government of Iraq or given to the Free Syrian Army or whatever, someplace that we can control them and where the an environment where you need it. No one's going to be using an IED against you. Go buy a Brinks truck. Most SWAT teams that I've worked with have those. So I'm quite surprised back here.
Where was home for you?
I was originally born in Philadelphia, and my home is Hudson, New York.
Okay. But you grew up in Philly?
Yeah, I grew up in Philadelphia.
All right. Any other letters, Alan?
Well, yes. There is Maria who said, that wasn't her. Okay, Luca said, on August 27th, I sent the following question. If ISIS is undermining Islam, why isn't the Muslim world expressing outrage and fighting this fight? Your guest has addressed the basis of my question. Thank you. I just thought.
All right, awesome. That's a nice.
That. Right.
Good job.
Right. Good job. And I think that's it. Did you see anything else?
That seems
Joe?
Good. Yeah.
Yeah.
We got some links and stuff, but yeah, I think that's for letters and comments. That was what we have. In our few minutes left, we were talking at the president. Sort of alluded to this in his address on Wednesday night, and I'm curious of your thoughts when we talk about timeline. I mean, is it even possible to put some sort of timeline on this?
Well, you know, you've been fighting this war since technically 2003.
Right.
We've been fighting against Al-Qaeda-backed groups since 1988. Our first military action came in against the United States in 1991. So this war has been going on. It is a multi-generational war, for one reason and one reason only, because you're not fighting just men. You're fighting the ideology, the mindset of men. And until you break that mindset, and in my second book, An End to Al-Qaeda, I put out that strategy. There's a famous Rachel Maddow interview where we go over what that strategy is, if you look on YouTube. It could be done in as quickly as 24 months. But to get it done in 24 months, you would have to have the buy-in of the Muslim world, who would flat out, every time that you make a tweet of a beheading, you take it down and then you have everybody come out and flood the zone with why this is not Islam. You have to make it so that it is no longer cool to carry out these executions or to join ISIS or to want to be part of their itinerant band of pirates. And right now, it's very cool for young men to do that. It's fun. It's something. It's a Muslim, not a Muslim, it's a cultist version of their special operations. So you have to do something about that. And we all have to work at that. Could the White House do it in 3 years? We could degrade them in a matter of a month, given all of the air power resources we have. But that won't take back the terrain. You have to go in there. It would take about a year to put up a military force, and then it's going to take another year to do sustained combat operations. So this is a long ball.
And if I'm reading you correctly, ultimately, it certainly wouldn't change the ideology.
No, you have to attack the battlefield in the mine. I mean, I was a trained sniper in the post-war when I worked in Iraq for a while, and I can shoot a man. It's easy to do. But you cannot destroy the man's belief system. And until you attack that, you know, until they are ashamed of being associated with it, you will always have new adherents.
Will you talk a little bit about, it's a media problem or a media situation where we talk about individuals in the military force rather than the force itself. Like if two men go missing, the concern of the media is we have to get them back, we have to get our men back. Isn't that different than the way we used to look at a military force, that these were men for whom we should be very grateful, and women now, who give their lives and make this kind of sacrifice?
Sure.
That's fascinating.
I mean, you know, we love, you know, now we, this generation loves our service people. We actually understand since 9/11 the sacrifices that they make.
Unlike Vietnam era.
Well, the Vietnam era, it's a shame how they were treated, but, you know, it was an unpopular war. And now the Iraq war became unpopular, and the American public's willingness to continue this is precisely why we're in the predicament that we are.
Well, I'm not so sure the American public was willing.
Willing to continue past 2009. But for the most part, I think that one of the problems that we have, and I think this was addressed in Rachel Maddow recently, was that we respond to provocation. The beheading of the two journalists, the way we're responding right now is no different than the way George W. Bush responded when the four Blackwater guards were killed in Fallujah. We did an immediate operation where we attacked Fallujah. We got hustled by the insurgents. And then 6 months later, we had to attack Fallujah and raise it to the ground. So what we need to do is we need to be, you know, I have to say, the president is a very thoughtful president. He doesn't jump into things. And we need to respect that and understand that people's lives are at risk over this.
We are out of time for our conversation this morning. My great thanks to Malcolm Nance for joining us this morning on behalf of all of us. Thank you so much, sir. It's a great pleasure to have you
be with us this
morning, and I hope you will join us very, very soon. Alan, Rosemary, thank you as well. Have a great weekend, and we'll meet back on Monday.
Okay.
Thanks, Big
Excellent.
Joe.
The roundtable continues on WAMC.